The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Countdown with Keith Olbermann is a production of iHeartRadio. If I told you Donald Trump was an animal who should be removed immediately, not removed from office, but just removed, if I told you Trump was, quote, doing the work of the devil, if I told you Trump was destroying our country, quote, as they tell us to be peaceful, if I showed you two pictures, one of Trump and next to it one of me, and I'm holding a baseball bat about to swing it, posed exactly as Robert De Niro portraying Al Capone was in the movie The Untouchables just before he beat another character to death with a baseball bat. If I showed you 30 other social media posts I had made in 24 hours, each of them filled with threatening and violent and hateful language about Donald Trump, what would you think I was trying to tell you? What would you think I was hoping you would do? Donald Trump is a stochastic terrorist, and the Stormy Daniels case is legitimate but comparatively trivial, and the Jack Smith special counsel investigations are legitimate and anything but trivial. But Trump's posts yesterday about Alvin Bragg, the baseball bat photo post, and the post reading, quote, a Soros-backed animal who just doesn't care about right or wrong, no matter how many people are hurt, and the post reading, quote, this is the Gestapo, this is Russia and China, but worse, and the post reading, quote, who should be removed immediately. These are terrorist threats made by Donald Trump on a public platform. Arrest him now for terrorism. And his intent and his process and his awareness that his words will be interpreted by the most deranged of his cultists as calls, as instructions to kill Alvin Bragg and to kill Jack Smith and to kill Letitia James and to kill Fannie Willis. His awareness of all that process is undeniable because Trump has used stochastic terrorism to incite January 6th. And dozens of the violent insurrectionists of that day who attacked the Capitol said on trial under oath, most with a sense of surprise, that everybody didn't already understand this, that they went to capture or kill senators and congressmen and a vice president and the media because Donald Trump told them to. Stochastic terrorism is often a vague thing. That is why it is used. You say something, somebody else goes and kills or maims or destroys on your behalf, and you respond, I never told them to do that. It is the King Henry II excuse. Will no one rid me of this turbulent priest? Said King Henry about the Archbishop of Canterbury on Christmas Day 1170. And 4 days later, Hugh de Morville, William de Tracy, Reginald Fitzurse, and Richard Le Breton ran the Archbishop through with their swords. They, in 1170, then expressed surprise that everybody didn't already understand that their king had ordered them, or somebody, to kill the Archbishop. The murderers were excommunicated and punished, and on the premise that since he was only making a rhetorical statement, not unlike District Attorney Bragg is a danger to our country and should be removed immediately, King Henry got the benefit of the doubt, and he served another 17 years as the King of England. But Trump has already lost that benefit of the doubt. He attacked the FBI last summer for executing a completely legal search warrant at Mar-a-Lago. Days later, a Trump fanatic tried to get into FBI headquarters in Cincinnati to kill FBI agents. That was Trump committing terrorism by proxy, stochastic terrorism. January 6th followed a series of tweets and posts and speeches and his screeching quote that morning, "If you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore." That was Trump committing terrorism by proxy, stochastic terrorism. Before the 2008 midterms, Trump attacked Democrats and liberals in a way never heard before in American politics, and Cesar Sayoc then sent pipe bombs to Joe Biden and Cory Booker and John Brennan and James Clapper and Hillary Clinton and Robert De Niro and Kamala Harris and Eric Holder and Barack Obama and George Soros and Tom Steyer and Maxine Waters. And a year later, when the FBI finally got through Sayoc's laptop, it turned out there was a second list of targets, and I know this because I was on that list. That was Trump committing terrorism by proxy, stochastic terrorism. And these social media rage tweets yesterday, primarily against Alvin Bragg, but mentioning James and Smith and Willis, they are implausibly deniable instructions to whoever is sick enough and violent enough and lost enough to accept them as what they were intended. Instructions. Trump told me to attack Alvin Bragg. Trump committing terrorism by proxy. Stochastic terrorism. This is going to have to stop, and it is going to have to stop immediately because of all the things that happened on January 6th, 2021. The one we talk the least about is the fact that this country on that day was extraordinarily goddamned lucky. Well, somebody's luck is going to run out. Ours or Trump's? And no, specifically, precisely, and exactly, nobody should attack Trump or menace Trump or shoot Trump or kill Trump. Or any Republican. But if the words that Trump wrote yesterday about Alvin Bragg were written about him, what would you think the writer meant? This is stochastic terrorism. This is not subtle stochastic terrorism, nor vague stochastic terrorism, nor gray area stochastic terrorism. The Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Justice need to act immediately, ahead of the special prosecutor, and with the same urgency with which one would approach the Republican cliche of 2003, the ticking nuclear time bomb in some American city. Charge, indict, and arrest Trump, and do it today. He is a stochastic terrorist. He must be stopped by the law, not by vigilantism nor terrorism. And he must be prosecuted and convicted by the law. Because as we have all seen for the last 8 years, the moment you let a stochastic terrorist like Donald Trump get away with it once, the premise, "Will no one rid me of this turbulent prosecutor, reporter, Democrat, liberal, vice president," the premise of that becomes more and more normalized and more prevalent and more understood by the diseased minds that accept Trump's word as a message from their president. You do not have to thrust a knife into someone to be convicted of murder in this country. Ask Charles Manson. You do not have to have built a bomb nor thrown a bomb to go to jail because a bomb was built and thrown. Ask Kathy Wilkerson of the Weathermen. You do not have to have protested the building of Cop City in Georgia, nor even to have been there to be arrested and jailed without bond. Ask DeKalb County District Attorney Sherry Boston. And you do not have to wait until somebody tries to hurt a man named Alvin Bragg to apprehend the creature who is inciting, insisting, demanding, encouraging, beseeching, instigating, instructing somebody, anybody, to hurt him. Or hurt Letitia James, or hurt Jack Smith, or hurt Fannie Willis. Arrest Donald Trump today. And when he is arrested in New York or elsewhere or everywhere, the judge or judges must do two things. A complete gag order. Trump has lost his right to speak aloud in this nation. And after his threats and his implorations, he has proven he is a material, lethal danger to the prosecutors and the witnesses and anyone who thwarts him. He wants them to be killed. He wants others to kill them. There must not be, there must never be, bail for Donald Trump. Separate of the commentary, let me give you the headlines from the Trump Stormy Daniels story. As you know, the grand jury reconvened yesterday but did not address this case. It will reconvene Monday, reconvene, I guess, presumably to pick up Trump's indictment on business and electoral crimes. Attorney General Bragg did act against some of those attempting to obstruct justice in this case, namely three of Kevin McCarthy's lawless fellow travelers in Congress. The Manhattan District Attorney's General Counsel replied to a letter from Jamie Comer, whose college girlfriend says he beat her, and Jim Jordan, who is accused of covering up rape at Ohio State, and Brian Stile, who appears to have misled the Capitol Police into opening a January 6th video viewing station they thought was for congressmen but was actually for Tucker Carlson. The three wanted details and documents from Bragg about the Trump investigation. The answer was, ask Trump. The congressional letter to the Manhattan DA's office, quote, only came after Donald Trump created a false expectation that he would be arrested the next day, and his lawyers reportedly urged you to intervene. Neither fact is a legitimate basis for congressional inquiry. The general counsel went on to remind the three McCarthy henchmen of the independence of state law enforcement from federal interference. However, it does offer to meet with committee staff to see if there might be some basis to share any information, and it underscores that the demands of the three scumbag congressmen are illegal. It was a very polite, very businesslike, and very profound F you. As I have mentioned here previously, Congress might have enough Republican votes to hold Alvin Bragg in contempt. Such a citation would be referred to the Department of Justice, which would ignore it. A Republican attorney general would probably also ignore it. Politicians cannot access details of ongoing investigations, in part because so many of them are the subjects of ongoing investigations. Back in Washington, Comer and McCarthy replied by saying stupid things, even for them. McCarthy said of Bragg, quote, he doesn't prosecute anybody, he only does political ones. Comer, who is just not bright, said something even not brighter than usual. Quote, a local DA prosecuting a presidential candidate over federal election law that happened 6 years ago, that's a little unprecedented, unquote. That also neglects that you cannot prosecute a sitting president, so there was no window for four of those years, January 2017 to January 2021. Moron. One more headline. Rolling Stone reporting, Trump's lawyers have told him that if he is indicted and tried in New York, he is going to lose that case and so should set his hopes on the appeal, which might help to explain the 34 stochastic terrorist posts. still ahead of us on this edition of Countdown. We are in the moment between starbursts of excitement in the Dominion lawsuit against Fox. But maybe we ain't seen nothing yet. How about hearing this? The plaintiff calls as the next witness Rupert Murdoch. And there could be another lawsuit against Fox that would make at least three big-time ones, and it could stem directly from Tucker Carlson's attempt to gaslight the world about January 6th, and it may be filed by a man named Ray Epps. And in worse persons, he is an upright congressman from Utah and a former football star. He's trying to get the House to stop the Biden student debt cancellation plan after he filed for bankruptcy five times. That's next. This is Countdown.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am like I am where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how. I don't know where. I don't know what. God, if you show me. God, if you tell me. God, if no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Countdown with Keith Olbermann.
Postscripts to the news. Some headlines, some updates, some snarks, some predictions. Dateline Wilmington, Delaware. Just when you thought the Dominion voting system's defamation suit against Fox, quote, news, unquote, was cooling off. At a preliminary hearing, the Delaware Superior Court judge, who will decide if the suit continues and will preside over it if it does, asked the Fox lawyers something very interesting. Did ownership, quote, have the power to stop, unquote, TV hosts from booking guests who might have been lying about the 2020 election outcome? Rupert Murdoch, said Judge Eric Davis, holds a special role at Fox Corporation that he may be able to be compelled to be here. Davis has yet to decide if he might issue summary judgment. Both sides want it. If not, jury selection starts April 13th. and Rupert Murdoch's testimony begins, well, we'll see. Dateline Arizona, Fox may have another suit to deal with. A lawyer for Ray Epps has written to Tucker Carlson, don't worry, somebody will read it to him, demanding a retraction of his, quote, false and defamatory statements that Epps was a government plant who instigated the January 6th coup. He also wants a, quote, formal on-air apology for the lies from Carlson. The fanciful notions that Mr. Carlson advances on his show regarding Mr. Epps' involvement in the January 6th insurrection are demonstrably and already proven to be false. And yet Mr. Carlson persists with his assault on the truth. Thank you, Nancy Faust. And Dateline Tallahassee, Ron DeSantis announced details of his intention to roll back the First Amendment, and he emphasized one particular aspect. If they're using anonymous sources, then that can be a presumption that that was done with malice, unquote. Several commentators have noted that if anonymous sources are suddenly presumed to be evidence of malice, the entirety of right-wing media will disappear overnight. So go, Rhonda. DeSantis is my choice for leader of a party going after drag queens while he wears high-heeled shoes and tries to put the New York Post out of business. Still ahead, every dog has its day. Even the dog that bit people. Please meet Muggs. On Fridays with Thurber, next. First time for the Daily Roundup of the Miscreants, Morons, and Dunning-Kruger effect specimens who constitute today's worst persons in the world. The bronze, Apple TV Plus. A year ago, Apple TV Plus brought America possibly the worst set of live sports broadcasts since Monday Night Football inexplicably put Dennis Miller in the booth with Al Michaels. Friday Night Baseball on Apple TV Plus. I believe there were seven, maybe eight different regular announcers who did two games every Friday night, and they were all replaced for this season, except for one of the dugout reporters. Naturally, Apple has announced that something else has changed for this year. Friday Night Baseball was free last year, but this year you'll need to have a subscription to Apple TV Plus. $7 a month to watch. $7? I mean, when Apple TV Friday Night Baseball was free, it was overpriced. Runner-up, the New York Post columnist Paul Sperry, naturally the Murdoch Rags minion, used the paper's unique ability to leave out just enough facts to lie without really lying. Sperry tweeted a link to a London Daily Mail article from last year attacking Manhattan DA Alvin Bragg's story of having grown up in a rough neighborhood in Harlem. The article noted that the brownstone on 139th Street in which he was raised is now worth $2.1 million. The article also left out that in 1985, when Bragg was growing up in that neighborhood, the city of New York was auctioning off brownstones throughout Harlem, including one on Bragg's exact street, on his block of 139th Street, Stryver's Row, one that the city owned because previous owners had defaulted. The entire building, in a neighborhood where they're now worth $2.1 million, the entire brownstone was auctioned off for $156,000. Paul Sperry, con man. But our winner, Burgess Owens, All-America defensive back, former New York Jet, and member of the 1980s Super Bowl champion Raiders, and since 2021, the esteemed Republican congressman from the 4th District of Utah. He is chairing a congressional committee investigating the Biden student debt relief program. Owens is very pious about this. Quote, debt cannot be canceled, he scolds, only transferred from those who borrowed to those who did not. The newspaper, the Salt Lake City Tribune, noted something else that was kind of flowery and unusual about Congressman Owens' stance on this. Quote, federal court records show Owens filed for bankruptcy five times. No, sir. Debt cannot be canceled, can it, Congressman? But clearly you can try like hell, huh? Burgess, one All-America team, two Chapter 7 bankruptcy filings, three Chapter 13 bankruptcy filings. Owens, today's worst person in the world!
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am, like I am, where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how, I don't know where, I don't know what. God, if you show me, God, if you tell me, God, no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Still ahead on Countdown, Fridays with James Thurber. James Thurber loved dogs, and he loved imperfect dogs. Like Muggs, the dog who bit people. First, in each edition of Countdown, fittingly, we feature a dog, usually an imperfect dog, who is in need and who you can help. Every dog has its day. Lace is not just on death row at the New York Pound. He's been taken off the public lists. That means he may be gone by the time you hear about him. But our pledges to help a dog rescue group pull and save and train him might yet pull off a miracle. Lace is a gray-black dog, a pity, so he's got strikes against him already. Yet he loves other dogs and people. He may have too much energy for kids, but he's never bitten, he's never guarded stuff, and he's 18 months old. You can find Lace on my Twitter feeds. Just your retweet can also help. Your pledge would help more. I thank you, and Lace thanks you. to the number one story on the countdown and Fridays with Thurber. And it's amazing to me in retrospect how I read all of his wonderful, realistic, not goopy writing about dogs and enjoyed it thoroughly years before I was ever adopted by a dog. Now, reading his dog stories and anecdotes is like reading about a bunch of friends. Even that one surly friend for whom we must continuously make excuses. The Dog That Bit People by James Thurber. Probably no one man should have as many dogs in this life as I have had, but there was more pleasure than distress in them for me, except in the case of an Airedale named Muggs. He gave me more trouble than all the other 54 or 5 put together, although my moment of keenest embarrassment was the time a Scotch terrier named Jeannie, who had just had 6 puppies in the clothes closet of a fourth-floor apartment in New York, had the unexpected 7th and last at the corner of 11th Street and 5th Avenue during a walk she had insisted on taking. Then, too, there was the prize-winning French poodle, a giant big black poodle, none of your little untroublesome white miniatures, who got sick riding in the rumble seat of a car with me on her way to the Greenwich Dog Show. She had a red rubber bib tucked around her throat, and since a rainstorm came up when we were halfway through the Bronx, I had to hold over her a small green umbrella, really more of a parasol. The rain beat down fearfully, and suddenly the driver of the car drove into a big garage filled with mechanics. It happened so quickly that I forgot to put the umbrella down. And I will always remember with sickening distress the look of incredulity mixed with hatred that came over the face of the particular hardened garage man that came over to see what we wanted when he took a look at me and the poodle. All garage men and people of that intolerant stripe hate poodles with their curious haircuts, especially the pom-poms that you've got to leave on their hips if you expect the dogs to win a prize. But the Airedale, as I have said, was the worst of all my dogs. He really wasn't my dog, matter of fact. I came home from a vacation one summer to find that my brother Roy had bought him while I was away. A big, burly, choleric dog, he always acted as if he thought I wasn't one of the family. There was a slight advantage in being one of the family, for he didn't bite the family as often as he bit strangers. Still, in the years that we had him, he bit everybody but Mother, and he made a pass at her once, but missed. It was during the month when we suddenly had mice, and Muggs refused to do anything about them. Nobody ever had mice exactly like the mice we had that month. They acted like pet mice, almost like mice somebody had trained. They were so friendly that one night when Mother entertained at dinner the Frirolilas, a club she and my father had belonged to for 20 years, she put down a lot of little dishes with food in them on the pantry floor so that the mice would be satisfied with that and would not come into the dining room. Muggs stayed out in the pantry with the mice, lying on the floor, growling to himself, not at the mice, but about all the people in the next room that he would have liked to get at. Mother slipped out into the pantry once to see how everything was going. Everything was going fine. It made her so mad to see Muggs lying there, oblivious of the mice. They came running up to her that she slapped him. And he slashed at her but didn't make it. He was sorry immediately, Mother said. He was always sorry, she said, after he bit someone, but we could not understand how she figured this out. He didn't act sorry. Mother used to send a box of candy every Christmas to the people the Airedale bit. The list, finally, contained 40 or more names. Nobody could understand why we did not get rid of the dog. I didn't understand it very well myself, but we didn't get rid of him. I think that one or two people tried to poison Muggs. He acted poisoned once in a while, and old Major Moberly fired at him once with his service revolver near the Seneca Hotel in East Broad Street. But Muggs lived to almost 11 years old, and even when he could hardly get around, he bit a congressman who had called to see my father on business.
My mother had never liked the congressman. She said the signs of his horoscope showed he couldn't be trusted. He was Saturn with the moon in Virgo. But she sent him a box of candy that Christmas anyway. He sent it right back, probably because he suspected it was trick candy. Mother persuaded herself that it was all for the best that the dog had bitten him, even though father lost an important business association because of it. I wouldn't be associated with such a man, mother said. Mugs could read him like a book. We used to take turns feeding Mugs to be on his good side, but that didn't always work. He was never in a very good humor, even after a meal. Nobody knew exactly what was the matter with him. But whatever it was, it made him irascible, especially in the mornings. Roy, my brother, never felt very well in the morning either, especially before breakfast. And once when he came downstairs and found that Muggs had moodily chewed up the morning paper, he hit him in the face with a grapefruit and then jumped up on the dining room table, scattering dishes and silverware and spilling the coffee. Muggs' first free leap carried him all the way across the table and into a brass fire screen in front of the gas grate. But he was back on his feet in a moment, and in the end he got Roy and gave him a pretty vicious bite in the leg. Then he was all over it. He never bit anyone more than once at a time. Mother always mentioned that as an argument in his favor. She said he had a quick temper, but that he didn't hold a grudge. She was forever defending him. I think she liked him because he wasn't well. He's not strong, she would say pityingly. But that was inaccurate. He may not have been well, but he was terribly strong. One time my mother went to the Chittenden Hotel to call on a woman mental healer who was lecturing in Columbus on the subject of harmonious vibrations. She wanted to find out if it was possible to get harmonious vibrations into a dog. He's a large, tan-colored Airedale, Mother explained. The woman said that she had never treated a dog, but she advised my mother to hold the thought that he did not bite and would not bite. Mother was holding the thought the very next morning when Muggs got the Iceman, but she blamed that slip-up on the Iceman. If you didn't think he would bite you, he wouldn't, Mother told him. He stomped out of the house in a terrible jangle of vibrations. One morning when Muggs bit me slightly, more or less in passing, I reached down and grabbed his short, stumpy tail and hoisted him into the air. It was a foolhardy thing to do, and the last time I saw my mother, about 6 months ago, she said she didn't know what possessed me. I don't either, except that I was pretty mad. As long as I held the dog off the floor by his tail, he couldn't get at me, but he twisted and jerked so, snarling all the time, that I realized I couldn't hold him that way very long. I carried him into the kitchen and flung him onto the floor and shut the door on him just as he crashed against it. But I forgot about the back stairs. Muggs went up the back stairs and down the front stairs and had me cornered in the living room. I managed to get up onto the mantelpiece above the fireplace, but it gave way and came down with a tremendous crash, throwing a large marble clock, several vases, and myself heavily to the floor. Muggs was so alarmed by the racket that when I picked myself up, he had disappeared. We couldn't find him anywhere, although we whistled and shouted, until old Mrs. Detweiler called after dinner that night. Muggs had bitten her once in the leg, and she came into the living room only after we assured her that Muggs had run away. She had just seated herself when, with great growling and scratching of claws, Muggs emerged from under a davenport where he had been quietly hiding all the time and bit her again. Mother examined the bite and put arnica on it and told Mrs. Detweiler that it was only a bruise. "He just bumped you," she said. But Mrs. Detweiler left our house in a nasty state of mind. Lots of people reported our Airedale to the police, but my father held a municipal office at the time and was on friendly terms with the police. Even so, the cops had been out a couple of times, once when Muggs bit Mrs. Rufus Sturtevant, and again when he bit Lieutenant Governor Malloy. But Mother told them it hadn't been Muggs' fault, but the fault of the people who were bitten. "When he starts for them, they scream," she explained. and that excites him. The cops suggested that it might be a good idea to tie the dog up, but Mother said that it mortified him to be tied up and that he wouldn't eat when he was tied up. Muggs at his meals was an unusual sight because of the fact that if you reached toward the floor, he would bite you. We usually put his food plate on top of an old kitchen table with a bench alongside the table. Muggs would stand on the bench and eat. I remember that my mother's uncle Horatio, who boasted that he was the third man up Missionary Ridge, was splutteringly indignant when he found out that we fed the dog on a table because we were afraid to put his plate on the floor. He said he wasn't afraid of any dog that ever lived, and that he would put the dog's plate on the floor if we would give it to him. Roy said that if Uncle Horatio had fed Muggs on the ground just before the battle, he would have been the first man up Missionary Ridge. Uncle Horatio was furious. "Bring him in! Bring him in now!" he shouted. "I'll feed the on the floor!" Roy was all for giving him a chance, but my father wouldn't hear of it. He said that Muggs had already been fed. "I'll feed him again!" bawled Uncle Horatio. We had quite a time quieting him. In his last year, Muggs used to spend practically all of his time outdoors. He didn't like to stay in the house for some reason or other. Perhaps it held too many unpleasant memories for him. Anyway, it was hard to get him to come in, and as a result, the garbage man, the ice man, and the laundry man would not come near our house. We had to haul the garbage down to the corner, take the laundry out and bring it back, and meet the ice man a block from home. After this had gone on for some time, we hit on an ingenious arrangement for getting the dog in the house so that we could lock him up while the gas meter was red and so on. Muggs was afraid of only one thing. An electrical storm. Thunder and lightning frightened him out of his senses. I think he thought a storm had broken the day the mantelpiece fell. He would rush into the house and hide under a bed or in a clothes closet. So we fixed up a thunder machine out of a long, narrow piece of sheet iron with a wooden handle on one end. Mother would shake this vigorously when she wanted to get Muggs into the house. It made an excellent imitation of thunder, but I suppose it was the most roundabout system for running a household that was ever devised. It took a lot out of Mother. A few months before Muggs died, he got to seeing things. He would rise slowly from the floor, growling low, and stalk stiff-legged and menacing toward nothing at all. Sometimes the thing would be just a little to the right or left of a visitor. Once a Fuller brush salesman got hysterics, Muggs came wandering into the room like Hamlet following his father's ghost. His eyes were fixed on a spot just to the left of the Fuller brush man, who stood it until Muggs was about 3 slow, creeping paces from him. Then he shouted. Muggs wavered on past him into the hallway, grumbling to himself, but the Fuller man went on shouting. I think Mother had to throw a pan of cold water on him before he stopped. That was the way she used to stop us boys when we got into fights. Muggs died quite suddenly one night. Mother wanted to bury him in the family lot under a marble stone with some such inscription as, "Flights of angels sing thee to thy rest," but we persuaded her it was against the law. In the end, we just put up a smooth board above his grave along a lonely road. On the board I wrote with an indelible pencil, "Cave Canem." Mother was quite pleased with the simple, classic dignity of the old Latin epitaph. The Dog That Bit People by James Thurber. I've done all the damage I can do here. Thank you for listening. Tell the others. Here are credits. Most of the music was arranged, produced, and performed by Brian Ray and John Philip Chenail. who are the Countdown musical directors. All orchestration and keyboards by John Philip Chenail. Guitars, bass, and drums by Brian Ray, produced by TKO Brothers. Other Beethoven selections have been arranged and performed by the group No Horns Allowed. The sports music is the Olbermann theme from ESPN2, and it was written by Mitch Warren Davis, courtesy of ESPN Inc. Musical comments by Nancy Faust, the best baseball stadium organist ever. Our announcer today was Larry David. Everything else is pretty much my fault. So that's Countdown for this, the 808th day since Donald Trump's first attempted coup against the democratically elected government of the United States. Arrest him now for stochastic terrorism while we still can. The next scheduled Countdown is Monday. Until then, I'm Keith Olbermann. Good morning, good afternoon, good night, and good luck. Countdown with Keith Olbermann is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets,
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters. Every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.